George Ray is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Maryland. He works primarily in philosophy of mind and cognitive science and has written numerous articles on the problems surrounding rationality, irrationality, concepts, linguistic competence, qualitative experience and consciousness, as well as the book Contemporary Philosophy of Mind, where he defends a computational representational theory of mind as a strategy for dealing with the study of consciousness. He has been a visiting professor at MIT, Stanford University, the Australian National University in Canberra, the School of Advanced Study, University of London, the Centre for the Study of Mind in Nature at the University of Oslo, the University of Split in Zadar, where he served as a Fulbright Fellow, as well as being a visiting lecturer at the École Polytechnique in Paris. He holds a PhD in philosophy from Harvard University. As a starting point, just give an overview of the computational theory of mind and some specific reasons of why it's the best option we currently have on the table when we come to explaining mind and consciousness, even though mind and consciousness aren't necessarily the same thing from the standpoint of particular studies, but why the computational theory of mind is the best option on the table and primarily what it is.
The computational theory of mind is actually not a single theory, really a research program, but I do think it's the most promising research program any of these ever conceived for approaching the mind. And of course, by the mind, I mean much, much more than conscious of, which I think is even in a weak sense, which we'll come to.
So CRTT is not a single finished theory, but a promising research program. Indeed, the most promising and fruitful research program about the mind I think anyone has ever conceived. Note that by the mind, I don't mean conscious states or processes. These are the tip of the iceberg. Most contemporary psychology is concerned with a wide variety of what seem to be largely unconscious mental processes involved in, for example, vision and other forms of perception, memory, rational and even irrational reasoning, decision-making, and most notably, language competence processing and acquisition.
The core idea is one that is really a combination of an idea that Turing had and a particular suggestion that, among other people, Jerry Fodor advanced in the 1970s. In the case of thought processes, you should really understand them as computations over syntactically structured representations, i.e. sentences in a language of thought. And the reasons for that have to do with the fact that it's only a language with syntactic structures, causally efficacious syntactic structures, that you can express logical relations of the sort that are involved in reasoning. Computations over syntactically structured representations that are actually capable of capturing rational relations and irrational relations between our thoughts and our perceptions and our action. And that's the research program, I believe, is being pursued in, as we speak, in a wide variety of inquiries into the mind.
So that's a breakdown of what the computation theory of mind is and why it's generally deemed as being the most appropriate tool we have in terms of structuring the way our mind represents phenomena from the real world. Generally, it's syntactic structures. The problem then arises, obviously, where we get certain issues of, you get notions of qualia and problems of the hard problem, whether all this conscious experience or what we actually conceive of as the mind, again, they're not necessarily the same thing, come about from these issues. And it's generally an issue of how we define consciousness. I mean, part of the problem with people that think that the mind and consciousness can't be reduced down to neural structures of the brain is the way they define a particular problem of consciousness, and this then later becomes something that's, as you rightly term, called strong consciousness that we'll get to shortly. But from your perspective, how is it the best way to define consciousness or the best way to think about consciousness?
I am averse to defining any of these terms prior to rich theories of them. But I think what we can do is to, take our ordinary notions and notice there are a bunch of constraints on them or a bunch of themes that are crucial to them, and think about those and maybe preserve some advance of others. That we can do both here and with any concept, I think, as we progress in science. In the case of consciousness, I think for the time being, we can simply go on people's introspections. People introspect, they think they're conscious and they're having feelings, sensations. That's interesting. Suppose we just took them at their word and see if theory of what's going on when they make these reports. You know, they seem, you know, there's a cluster of issues about their immediacy, their richness. Some of the details of them in psychophysics correlate the perceived amplitudes with actual amplitudes in the stimulus. So, you know, there's a cluster of facts that we know about, at least involving these reports of consciousness. And that's enough to begin theorizing about and saying, well, what's going on? And what I'm interested in is the fact that, well, on the one hand, there's a cluster of reports. And on the other, there's the fact that a computational theory of mind could be run on a desktop computer equipped with a video camera and a robotic arm. And what's disconcerting about that is that although it also, as I argue in some papers, might well be able to, quote, introspect and report on its sensations and, you know, say the very same things you and I say when we are stimulated by the environment, you know, most of us would not regard it as conscious for a second. In fact, a particularly nice puzzle I like is the fact that I think I quote this in that Frankish article that you mentioned. Researchers in psychology standardly think up computational models for certain processes. Good deal of work on pain perception, and they run the model on a computer. Now, what is interesting about this is that they don't hesitate for a second in thinking that the computer is not conscious. They don't for a moment think they're putting the computer in pain. But then there's a puzzle. If they think they've given an adequate theory of pain, then why? What is missing in the case of the computer? And that's the question I like, because I think it's extremely hard to see what could be left out. On the one hand, everybody feels something's been left out, but it's notoriously hard to say what that might be.
In talking about how it is a computer can basically simulate computations of perception, intention, and action, and for a large part be as conscious as a human, that's obviously one aspect of weak consciousness versus strong consciousness. And talking about the Frankish paper, you've also said that when dealing with these issues, we've got to talk about the extent to which the computer has the capacity to be introspective, or whether it not it is in terms biological, because it seems to be, by arbitrary standards, two de facto definitions of what somehow strong consciousness must be, as in this entity that has strong consciousness must be capable of introspecting and also being somehow biological. Now, you've said how a computer can give feedback on its introspection, so that deals with one aspect of it and blows that potential issue of consciousness out of the water. And also, obviously, a computer isn't biological, so that's two issues dealt with. Now, just to be crystal clear on this issue, the researchers that model pain on computers never explicitly state that the computer is in pain or the computer is not in pain. The more interesting point here is the simple fact that they never address the potential issue that the computer could be in pain. Without speculating too much here, it's probably due to the unconscious bias in which they assume that the computer just can't be in pain, which simultaneously creates a paradox whereby their actual model then becomes inadequate. But the issue with pain is very interesting, because I completely agree with what you're saying in terms of if people are modelling pain on a computer and they're basically running a computation that says this object and this entity is currently in pain, but then they're also saying it's actually not in pain, as in the first entity sensation of being in pain, then, as you say, that gives rise to the problem of, well, what is it actually doing? Is it actually in pain? Is it not in pain? And if it is in pain, then what kind of pain is it? So I think this is a very interesting issue that you raise. So when they run these kind of tests, are you essentially saying that it's the computer is actually capable of being in pain, or is the problem with how pain is defined in this term of a sensation?
Well, I'm in a way reading a paradox. If the researchers think of themselves as providing a theory of pain or a model of pain, then when they run it on the computer, it would seem to follow the computer should be in the very pain that they're attempting to model. But they don't seem to believe that for an instant. Nobody worries about the cruelties of the computer. And so the question is, well, okay, so their theory must not be adequate. So what else do they think has to be added? Now, you said a minute ago, and something I wanted to correct slightly, that, well, a computer by definition couldn't be biological. Well, that's not quite right. You could have biological computers. There's no reason why it couldn't, and maybe our brain is one of them. What's interesting is that when a computer is not biological, then we're disinclined to attribute to it conscious mental states. It seems as though we insist upon biology as being a necessary condition for consciousness and qualia as we think of them. And then the question is, what entitles us to that assumption? Okay, what's the relation?
It seems a completely arbitrary requirement. I see how a computer could be biological, but I just meant in a very crude way in terms of it's made of electronic wires.
Yeah.
But yes, in theory, the brain could be a biological and organic computer. Moving on to this idea, which we've kind of been heading to for the last few moments, which is this idea of consciousness as an illusion and something that rubs people the wrong way for reasons you've already alluded to earlier. So we can run a computation model on a computer about pain, yet the computer, in paradoxical terms, due to these researchers, isn't actually in pain. So there's something else that must be administered above the computation for it to be in actual pain. And people that are reductionists, at the extreme case like Daniel Dennett, would say that there isn't a need to postulate an additional layer or dimension to a sensation. It just is that sensation. And obviously, in the paper that you talked about, Keith Frankish, you also give the Dan Dennett example of how if someone is in the sensation of pain and you give them a painkiller, then you don't need to tell them that there's anything magical happening apart from their sensation of pain.
That doesn't capture exactly the puzzle that Dan and I probably independently are raising. The puzzle is not, the way you put it is a little confusing because it's not clear whether you're saying the person is in pain or not. What's puzzling is this. Suppose I get you into a computational state such that, we can establish independently that you quite sincerely believe you're in intense pain and very, very much wish you weren't. I mean, you dislike the state just as much as you do any state of pain. But then we're told, but you're not biological or you're lacking this certain je ne sais quoi, biological phenomenon, a biological condition. But the question is, what would it matter to you? It doesn't matter a bit. All that seems to matter are the beliefs and the desires you have, roughly speaking. The fact that you believe you're in intense pain, say in your tooth, and you very, very, very much wish not to be having that state. And, I think both Dan and I think that's all you need. What more do you want? And what more would it do you? Because, do you really want to insist, I need to have that for the thing as well? Would you be happy if somebody deprived you of this further condition and you still believed you're in pain, didn't want to be? Right. That seems virtually unintelligible. And so that's the paradox, because it looks like we can put the machine in exactly that state.
Would there be a certain truth to saying that a lot of these contentious issues that arise around weak and strong consciousness has to do with the way people actually define the terms within a certain paradigm? For example, someone like David Chalmers that advocates the hard problem, the explanatory gap, they're saying that there must be something more to qualia by definition, because there has to be something that captures that subjectivity. And from that context, by definition, the subjectivity of that first person sensation is something more than the neural computational basis of the brain. As where, on the other side of the argument, people that don't recognize the hard problem and see consciousness as some sort of an illusion also operate by the definition that it simply just is one and the same thing. You don't need to posit an additional subjective first person qualia sensation. It just literally is the same thing. And that comes into examples of you're saying about the person in pain. You don't need to posit these additional formats. What difference would it make? It literally is one and the same thing. Is definition an important part of this contentious issues?
I don't like to put it in terms of definition, I think. But the point is that, in given these cases, we come up with very strong intuitive verdicts. We think that, oneself is in pain. If you stab him with a hot poker and I believe I'm in pain and very, very, very much wish I wasn't, you weren't stabbing me with a hot poker, then that would seem on the one hand to be enough. And yet, if you put something non-biological into that state, it doesn't seem to be enough. So it looks like the biology is supposed to be essential, and yet we can't figure out why. What is it about the biology that's crucial? That's the problem. And it's a problem, a kind of deep conflict in our intuitive verdicts, and we need to reconcile them. Okay? We need to either give one up or not the other, but it's very, very hard. I must confess, I find it hard even as someone who's convinced of my own arguments. I'm not about to, believe that my, I'm not, it doesn't, isn't easy for me to believe that my machine could be put into pain. in this way. On the other hand, I don't see what argument I can produce to establish that it couldn't be, along the lines I've suggested by being very specific about mental processes.
And that's true. And also, I think it's quite interesting, another argument that you cite from Frankish as well, which is we've got two options on the table for explaining consciousness as a general overview. And one of them would be a type of illusion that's still explainable versus some kind of extra entity that's inexplainable.
Yeah, he put it very nicely. It's better to have an explicable illusion than an inexplicable reality.
I completely agree. And it's also interesting, so the issues such as Gallium-Strawson, and there's another philosopher, Philip Goff, who's got a book coming out at the end of this year, which is another panpsychist tradition, which is very interesting in terms of what you also put in the Frankish paper, which is to posit this argument, these people would rather ascribe consciousness to absolutely literally everything, as opposed to just consciousness as this kind of perceived illusion that comes from one computational state, which I think is interesting as well.
So you raised panpsychism. I must say, I find it very, very hard to take it seriously as a hypothesis. And the arguments I've read for it by Gallium-Strawson and others strike me as simply specious. They simply don't follow. It doesn't follow in particular from the fact that, you know, some of our talk may be irreducible to other parts of our talk, a not unfamiliar problem, actually, in many parts of science. That therefore the property that is not irreducible, it must be pervasive. It must be ubiquitous. Inference. And I just don't know what it would mean or what reason I should possibly have to think a stone is conscious or an elementary particle is conscious. I'm just baffled why anybody takes that seriously. I have in my paper tried to be very specific in the way that psychologists are about specific processes that do look like they're responsible for thinking, reasoning, perception, and introspection and attention, say. And what I find interesting is that when one is specific about those processes, which arguably are related to consciousness, one comes up with proposals that could be realized on a computer, on a desktop computer. And that's the puzzle. Okay. When one not when one has some general philosophical view about everything being conscious, whatever that in the world that would mean. Here I'm just staying with the psychology and looking at specific psychological proposals and saying, huh, what's puzzling about these proposals is they can be realized on a laptop computer. And now the question is, well, how come we don't think the laptop or the desktop, if you like, is conscious? And that's the puzzle. I don't think appeals to panpsychism or even dualism or even mysterious hard problems makes any progress. You want to know what's the explanatory issue here. How are you going to establish that the computer is or is not really in genuine pain?
So I think the paradox raised by the computer in pain kind of highlights the problem here. I think in general where panpsychists come to it from an extreme point of view is from what end of the argument do you kind of focus in on? So, for example, out of all the material in the universe, only one bit of a physicalist material structure, the brain, would produce consciousness. Panpsychists would say that that's very strange in terms of if you look at the whole spectrum of everything in the universe, and yet only one aspect of physical material structure, the brain, produces consciousness. So they try to reverse it by saying that everything must have consciousness.
That's a bit rash.
Yes.
We may not be the only living things or the only things that metabolize in the universe. There may be other things that metabolize, digest, ruminate, and think, and are conscious. There may be, well, other things. But you have to explain what you mean. I mean, what kind of process do you have in mind, and how would it be distinctive of this system and not others? Merely wantonly ascribing it to electrons or positrons or rocks or mountains.
Everything by definition.
Intellectually preposterous and irresponsible. You want evidence. You want evidence and argument for thinking that an electron is conscious. And I just can't imagine what they seriously have in mind, except, as I say, some specious arguments about reductionism.
That was a point I was trying to get at. So, for example, their line of reasoning would be that, as I'm saying, by all the physical material structures in the universe, only one, the brain, produces consciousness.
We don't know that. There may well be other conscious things in the universe. I have no idea. So far as we know, it looks like, offhand, that we're the most salient creatures that have it. But maybe the computers have it. Maybe the birds and the bees have it. You have to get down and look at specific details. And I do think, by the way, that investigating animal psychology, even arthropod psychology, is quite interesting. Bees turn out to be a lot smarter than people had thought. I think the question is quite open whether they're conscious or not. I just don't think we know enough about the bees or about specifically what processes are responsible for consciousness in us.
And I completely agree. I was also pointing out another problem with the argument, because even if you give them that premise, which is, isn't it odd that only one physical structure in the universe has consciousness, therefore everything else must have consciousness? If you reverse that argument, you can say, well, why is it that one particular physical structure in the universe produces consciousness and nothing else does, if that is the case? Even if that was the case, you could just say it's because of the computations that happen in this physical structure that doesn't happen anywhere else. That's all you need not to be a panpsychist.
I quite agree. I take Joseph Levine's positing on the expansion of crap quite seriously. I'm quite less confident about Chalmers' postulation of dualistic processes, which I don't even see how they would be explanatory.
Not all philosophers in this area are necessarily dualists, even if they believe that the mind alone can't be explained by the brain.
Right.
With this in track, it's kind of interesting now to raise the point of why is it that this notion, which has been quite well precedented throughout history, that there is something more to the person than the material brain. There is something more to their conscious experience than just the brain. Obviously, at times was called the soul. There's also aspects of Cartesian dualism. Daniel Dennett says this is all kind of cultural conditioning and a product of a bygone era. You also mentioned similar aspects in terms of how humans cognitively program to recognize agency and intention in other objects and entities, whether they're conscious or not. So with all this in mind, why is it this idea has, first of all, was a start, and why it stayed around for so long, this idea that there must be something more to consciousness than just simple computations?
First of all, let's be clear. I think there's a really weak notion of materialism that's adequate to raise the problem. It's what I call simple bodily physicalism. We have every reason to believe from just mundane research into psychology and neurology is that there's nothing in our brain, nothing in the motions of our bodies or events in the brain that occurs that defies a present physical explanation. It just seems that we're just subsumable under the laws of physics as they stand. There's simply no reason, no evidence of our doing anything peculiar. So that's an important background premise. Now, it's true. People come and say, but there's something further. We've got to have consciousness or some kind of soul or free will. And the problem is adducing non-tendentious evidence for this. This is an important point I make. Many people at this point in the discussion will often, as I like to say, beat their breasts and say, but I know I'm conscious. I know that firsthand. I know it better than I know anything. As Descartes, said, and as Eccles and Popper and other people have said over the years, and Chalmers, I think, similarly declares. And I want to say, that's not very convincing, since that's tendentious evidence. It's like saying, I know there are ghosts. I met a ghost last night. And you say, what we have to do now is explain what you thought was meeting a ghost. And we have every reason to think there are no ghosts. So it must be some other process going on. Similarly, with consciousness, you simply can't beat your breast. You have to give some evidence that doesn't presuppose the very phenomena in dispute. And that's what I find strikingly hard to provide. All the cases you mentioned, actually, of consciousness, in the strong sort, freedom of the will of the strong sort, that people are worried about, and the existence of a soul, right? Just provide me any non-question-begging evidence that any of these things exist. And I think that's quite a serious challenge. It's very hard to meet.
That's true. For the reasons that you've mentioned, on the one hand, you say that what good reasons, what good evidence do we have to suppose strong consciousness? What kind of evidence would we need to say that consciousness is something more than just mere computation? And that's hard to do. And as you say, if you were to model a computer in pain, what more would you need to model into the computer for it to be in pain? Paradoxically, you also say that even though the computer has been modelled to be in pain, a lot of people would not consider it to be in pain. So that's the paradox between the two. How do we get out of this paradox? How do we get out of this problem? Do you see any ways forward, any ideas to resolve this? Or are you a kind of dead end in terms of saying that, well, I don't know what else we could add to the computational model for it to be kind of a discernible level of pain? And simultaneously, I don't know what reasonable arguments we could say that there is something more in terms of strong consciousness. Is there a way out of this kind of circular hole?
No, I think, as in the case of free will and soul, I think we're up against what seems to be a virtually ineluctable illusion that is built into us, okay? Or at least so it seems. And this is where I give my own explanation of what I think is going on, is that, you know, we have very good reason from psychological evidence to believe that human beings are innately endowed with very specific detectors and ways about specifically things that look and act like animals and people, so things that look and act like us. I think Wittgenstein puts it very well in investigations. He says, somewhat unselfconsciously, it's only of something that looks and behaves like a human being that we say it's conscious, has thoughts and feelings. And I say he's a bit unselfconscious about it because on reflection, I say, gee, that seems awfully arbitrary. Why on earth should we take that seriously? But nevertheless, it's true. I think he's hit a truth that, yes, that is true of us, that those are the things we feel comfortable with. And they are such deep ingrained responses. I can't help but hear you as speaking, as being an intentional agent moving around in a certain way, you know, certain beliefs and desires. I can't help but understand you in that way. And for that reason, I think you must have some property that a similarly programmed machine lacks, who doesn't look and act like and only has the same internal states. And I think it's that prejudice or that deeply innate fact of our responsiveness to our conspecifics that explains why we think there must be some special property corresponding to our ineluctable responses to things that look and act like this. And I think similarly for free will and for the soul, although we're not going into those today.
As you say, this is quite prominent over the research in cognitive science. I don't know if you've heard of Joshua Knobe, who's at Yale.
Yeah, sure.
He's done a lot of stuff on this about how we treat corporations different from people for many reasons like this. And also Andy Thompson, the psychologist, who's got an issue of why humans are pre-programmed to detect agency where agency might not be there as a evolutionary survival tool, in terms of if you thought there was a lion outside your cave, yeah, you're more likely to lose less if you go out and check than if you assume there isn't no agency. And so, as you say, there are many intriguing reasons. Obviously, you could use the example from Wittgenstein to assume that because through thousands of years of evolution, whenever we speak to another human, obviously, which is intuitively pre-programmed to assume that they must have an internal state like ours, but we can't yet put that onto a computer because computers, for a start, haven't been around as long as us, and they're qualitatively different from humans.
As a further explanation of the illusion, which I commend to your listeners to think about it anyway, it's a suggestion made by Wittgenstein in the investigations, which I quote, at some length in my paper. And I'll just, give you the summary idea here. You know, he's worried that philosophers, over-idealize our ordinary talk and often make posits. I think our ordinary talk is committed to posits there that, on reflection, disintegrate. They don't seem to be really there. A really simple example that I like to give, submerged from conversations I've had with Paul Petrosky, is the sky. You know, we quite cheerfully go to the beach and say, oh, it's a beautiful day. Look, the sky is blue. But now ask yourself, what is the sky? What object is that? It's a good exercise. I submit you're going to be hard put to say what the sky is, even though you're perfectly happy to say the sky is blue or the sky is gray or the sky is looking cloudy today. You seem to be referring to this thing. And yet on reflection, as it were, philosophical reflection, you find you can't identify what object you're talking about. I think, Wittgenstein wants to make a similar suggestion about our uses of the word conscious. We know what it is to say that somebody's conscious of their affection, conscious of the canary on the tree. We have all these uses of the word conscious. And as in the word sky, what we do too quickly is to assume there must be one thing that underlies all these uses. In the case of the sky, we say, oh, that's preposterous. There's no such thing as the sky. It's just a way of talking. It's a language, as Wittgenstein said, a language game we play. Well, similarly, that's an interesting proposal to make about consciousness, is that we may use the word conscious in a wide variety of ways, and there be no underlying phenomenon that unifies all of it, any more than there is in the case of the sky. I find that a really interesting suggestion that should supplement the suggestion about our involuntary responses to the things that look like us.
It's a good way to use Wittgenstein's science language games here in terms of, is there anything else in this area you want to say, George?
Well, I mean, one last thing is to simply ask people, I think it's very important to ask, why are you in fact so certain you're conscious? I mean, it's one thing, as it were, to find yourself thinking you're conscious. Another thing to think, I'm more certain about this than I am about anything. What entitles you to these further beliefs about the, as it were, the sanctity, importance, and centrality of consciousness? I think it's actually puzzling to wonder, where on earth did you get such an idea? And why should we take it seriously?
I think that's a valid point. I find this same subject matter that you're talking about right there quite interesting as well. I mean, why is it that there's a particular prowess to your ideas about consciousness in general, first-person consciousness? Surely that you can appreciate from everyday personal experience that at single points of the day, you don't experience the same conscious experience, which might be telling you, for a start, that this idea of what you think is consciousness is always in flux. So obviously the person that wakes up in the middle of the night completely half confused and may turn over in the middle of sleep is not the same conscious experience you have first thing in the morning after 10 minutes of coffee.
Good. I like that way of putting it. Yes.
Well, what part of you is conscious and what do you mean by this? Obviously the very drunk you isn't the same as the very sober you off lots of caffeine. So as you say, it's a very interesting point of where do people get this notion from. And I think as to what you're alluding to in terms of it's the way we've been pre-programmed is lends a lot of credence to explaining this, and also historical cultural concepts, something that Dennett would go after Descartes for. So yeah, I think that's a very fundamental point you make there. People should ask themselves, why is it I think this particular form of consciousness is more important than other forms of consciousness and experience, and why is it
there's any one thing unifying all of it? Yeah.
Exactly, that's a sort of different area to get into, where we have one unifying conscious experience that we haven't got time for today, which is also an interesting point. George, what are you working on currently in this area? What have you got coming out in terms of papers?
I've actually, partly for some of the reasons I gave about the importance of developing very specific proposals, I've retreated to very specific issues that come up, well, in my case, because it interests me, in the case of language and the representation of language. I can't possibly go into the full motivation for this, but I'm presently writing a book on the notion of representation in Chomskyan linguistics and related philosophical issues, which turns out to be, I think, quite confused and deserving of a lot of careful philosophical attention, partly because it's so scientifically important. It's important to get a clear idea of what specifically a Chomskyan proposal is about our the syntactic machine that he's positing in our brains. That turned out to be an astonishingly intricate issue, and that's the book I'm writing right now. I'm doing it in the spirit of trying to be as specific as possible about particular mental processes and what makes them mental. And that's the issue I happen to be addressing in the case of syntax and grammar, appreciation of them.
Is there a publication date for it yet?
It's under review at Oxford Press at the moment. I hope it'll come out in the next year.